This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Andrew Coe and Jane Ziegelman about their really wonderful book, A Square Meal, which is basically a history of food during the Depression. But I think it's more than that. I think it's actually a history of the Depression in a lot of ways with food as the lens. Am I right about that?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Good so point.
What prompt? I mean, before we talk about the book itself, what prompted you to spend a fair amount of time, which I assume you did, because there's a lot of research evidenced here? What prompted this?
Yeah, do it.
Well, we had both written books. I wrote a book on the history of Chinese food in the United States, and Jane had written a book about the history of food on the Lower East Side. And both of those books had sections which, you know, transpired during the 1930s. So we were aware of that time frame, and we were looking for another book to work on and, you know, another topic. And we realized that, A, the Depression had never been written about, and B, it was the time when food was the
food and the Depression had never been written.
Food,
yes,
the Depression has been written about a lot.
Correction,
right? But from a food standpoint of view, it had never been written about. And B, it was the time when food was one of the most important topics on people's minds, and it's never been so important. You know, was never so important before, and it's never been so important afterward. So this was a time when people really focused on it, from, you know, the president on down. Everybody was interested in food. And so we realized that this was a great topic.
Well, and people were interested in food because so many people were food challenged. You quote the I know it changed over a period of time. It's 10 years. There is not I think of the Depression. I think what happens when we say the Depression, people automatically kind of think of it as a block of time when things were really bad. But there were periods of ups and downs during that, which you talk about. And at the very beginning, in a way, not recognized really for what was going on. You know, the period at the early stage of the Depression, they were not even aware of how bad it was going to be. They couldn't
be. That's one of the features of that period that actually I found fascinating, which interested me and which I was trying to understand as we were researching, is this idea that the Great Depression was not capital G, capital D, until it was already years in the making. People didn't understand the sort of the size and the span and the scope of what was going on. And actually, food policy decisions were based on that.
On the not knowing.
On the
not understanding the scope and issue. Although there were these kind of, as you talk about, there were these, you know, you can't talk about it monolithically either in terms of geography, places where things were really bad, and where the societal response tried to cope with food problems. You know, it might have been in New York or in Chicago, but as you say, it was different in different parts of the country and at different times.
And it was dealt with very much on a local level,
right,
until there was a kind of consciousness that this was more than local, right, and it had to be dealt with in a kind of
systemic
way.
Right, and then there you see the president, Hoover, at the beginning, not failing to really grapple with what was going on, as evidenced by him eating incredibly well while the rest, you know, almost like...
Well, he was eating off of gold plates with gold-plated cutlery. Yeah.
I was thinking of Marie Antoinette, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was that kind of tone deafness going on. But it was also partly what, you know, you were starting to talk about, that at the beginning of the Depression, it wasn't even recognized. So he was not kind of capable of seeing the scope of the issue.
Yes.
And the other thing that I thought was really powerful as a theme that you talked about was this sort of Puritan ethos response to the notion of people suffering on this massive scale. So you have maybe 15, almost 20% unemployment.
25% at that.
25%
yeah,
at the worst.
33, yeah.
And at that point, you have really major food shortages, nutritional deficiencies at a high level. You know, there was all that argument about whether were people starving or not.
Right.
When clearly they were starving. But the political response was that people, the government should not support people to the full extent, the federal government in particular, because it's not the role of government to take care of its starving population.
Or actually, it's the role of governments other places. It's okay if the British take care of their people or people far away who aren't Americans, but it wasn't the American
Which is
the pure, correct American response.
Right. Because that is the, you know, rugged individualist idea is that you would, everyone would take care of themselves. And then, but that relates to a sort of, you know, the 19th century British idea that if you were poor, it's your fault. If you were unsuccessful in life, it's your fault. Therefore, when 25% of people were unemployed, it's their fault.
Well, poverty was—it was a moral failure.
Yes,
right. And that
so,
why
reward it?
Yeah, and it actually goes back not just to 19th century England, but back to the Puritans. You know, Cotton Mather and the Puritan preachers at the founding of you know, the United States in the early 1600s.
Right.
Yes.
And it goes back further.
But it's clearly enunciated in the Puritan ethos, so, you know, in the preaching of the early 1600s. And that's it becomes inculcated into the American way, you know, through the next 200 or 300 years.
And it's still going on
and
today.
And that's what I found really powerful was that if you read about the things that in your book that people, the Republicans at that time were saying, it's echoed by what you see on this very day.
Isn't it incredible?
When we have, you know, part of our country being told that they shouldn't have health insurance because, you know, it's a failure of their own, it's their failure that they're unhealthy. It's the same idea.
Right. It comes, if you have diabetes, that somehow it's because you're eating too much sweet food or junk food.
You have no self-control.
Right.
That's your,
Yes. And you should get rid of, you know, get rid of, you bought a new iPhone.
Oh, that
instead
was a good
of,
one,
That's, so that's kind of moral judgment.
Right.
Or that children shouldn't get school lunches.
Right. And the school,
because they'll learn a bad lesson from that.
That's
it sets a bad precedent.
Right. Whereas in the, in as you point out, the social worker kind of movement of the early 20th century comes to full fruition during the Depression because they are seeing firsthand the results of malnutrition among children, you know, that they are not able to learn because they are hungry. They have, you know, they're sleeping because they have no food. You know, they can't learn. And so you have the advent of school lunches as a program.
Yeah, one of the sort of little side stories that I couldn't kind of get enough of was this idea of the truant officers who worked for the public schools. This was in New York City, going out to chase kids who they thought were skipping school, playing hijinks.
Right.
And found when they went to the kids' homes that these were actually children who were too weak from hunger to leave the house. And these truant officers become sort of heroes delivering food and clothing and shoes to these impoverished New York families.
Right. And well, you also have, there's one description, it was fairly early in the book, and I couldn't tell whether that was early in the Depression only, but it was that the, you know, the police in New York were also delivering food to poor families. Was that something that happened throughout, or was that just at the beginning of the, you know, the Depression when you see this kind of first wave of collapse?
Well, that was New York specific. And they really saw the collapse sort of very vividly on the streets of New York. And so Mayor Jimmy Walker, in one of the few sort of really positive things that he did during his administration, organized a big relief campaign using like all the resources of city government. And the point men for this were the policemen. But that it only lasted for how long? Less than a year.
Less than a year.
Less than a year. And there was actually a reaction against it by the social workers because it was indiscriminate giving. you weren't like giving, tailoring what you were giving to the needs of the family.
It wasn't scientific.
Yes.
And so it was sentimental.
Yes.
So they ended it.
Yeah.
But it did feed people, which, you know, on the positive side. But very few other
detail about it.
Very few other communities actually, you know, in other parts of the country, did it, mainly, you know, due to the conservatism or lack of money or whatever. And it wasn't, the rest of the country didn't really get organized relief until FDR came in.
So what were you going to say?
The funny little tidbit about it is, although it was being administered by municipal government, it was being funded by private citizens, by municipal employees. So it still wasn't government help.
Right. And even when there was government help, I mean, even under FDR, when FDR came in, you know, there we have this idea that the social fabric was changed. You know, the safety net was built. But I got from your book that it was actually not quite that simple, and that FDR was not just a bleeding heart, as people might think of him as being, or the savior of, you know, everyone. Because, in fact, a lot of what they did was meant, they were worried about the same issue. Harry Hopkins and FDR were thinking, well, if we, and then they were saying, oh, I can see evidence that, you know, people have become dependent.
Right. Dependency was the big
yeah.
term.
So that they were, even FDR's administration was not simply saying, let's take care of our poor, starving population. They were saying, we need to put people to work so that they can earn their keep. And that's what the, you know, the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Project Administration were really about. They were very much in line with the American Puritan ethos.
But you know what? People wanted to work. It
yeah.
wasn't as if they were forcing people into
right,
jobs that they'd,
yeah.
they were hungry for work. So this idea that we shirk, or that there are work shirkers out there, certainly in the Depression, was not the case. These were people desperate for
right.
jobs and who felt the dignity of work was something important
right.
to them.
But I think that's true. Every you know, it's,
right.
it, this is a myth. I think
a
self, you know, a kind of projected, mm-hmm. maybe a projection, you know, that people who mistrust somehow the notion that, you know, mutuality actually leads to good. You know, I think it's a weird construct. You know, when I think about all these people who've read Ayn Rand and think somehow, you know, that it's, every single person is responsible for their, well, did you go to school? Do you drive on roads? You know, did anybody ever give you a hand? I mean, of course, it's a, you know, it's culture is mutual. But I like the, I mean, I think that it is this sort of fantasy that what FDR did, you know, that was somehow creating a, for, you know, a safety net that made people weaker and dependent. It's not true, as you point out.
Well, what made people weaker was malnutrition. I mean, physically weaker. And FDR built the safety net, but actually by the time of, he also pulled it away, and he kept changing the safety net, like, you know, adding something here and taking something out there. And so people were never sure what they would be getting from one month to the next, or whether they would be getting anything. And by the end of the beginning of World War II, a lot of the social safety net was taken away completely because it was too expensive, and they needed everything that they, you know, every resource had to go into the war effort.
Right. But of course, the war effort solved the problem.
Yes.
Ultimately, because the real issue was the kind of economic failure, and the war effort put everybody back to work. As you pointed out, I think 1943 unemployment rate was down to 1.9%. Problem solved.
Yes.
You know, you're either in the army or you're working, basically. I know we've talked about politics and
yeah.
but food is still part of the story. And, you know, I know we can't talk about all of the interesting kind of food things, but a lot of what you talked about in the book that I thought was interesting was the advent of this, of home economics, you know, or, and not necessarily the beginning of it, but its more popular form where what you alluded to earlier, the science of eating, you know, there was studying of vitamins, what makes you healthy, how can you live well on a not so good diet, you know, how can you maximize health? And that seemed to be a really big story because that didn't exist before.
Well, the way it worked was that home economics, as you said, predates the Depression. This movement by progressive women at the turn of the 20th century to sort of modernize our eating habits and replace sort of old-fashioned pre-modern ideas about food with a science-based nutritional approach to eating. So that begins 30 years before the Depression. But during the Depression, these women who had been sort of flogging their message were given a platform that what they had to say became, sadly, all too relevant to sort of large swaths of the American population. And people were suddenly receptive to the idea that they could eat strategically, nutritionally, in ways that would prevent their kids from getting malnutrition deformities, for example. So the message became intensely relevant.
But it was also at the same time a kind of, I mean, there was a narrowness to that, which I think you also talk about later in the book when you bring up, I think her name was Helen Nesbitt, who I thought was a really interesting precursor to the counter trend of, you know, the scientific view of food is there kind of takes away all the fun, takes away all of the variation and denies the power of kind of local, regional, cultural values, and that this came from a well-meaning place.
I mean, well, there's a puritanical streak in home economics as well. So in a way, we're going back to that substrate. The idea is that food that's good for you doesn't give you pleasure. And if you're too focused on pleasure, you'll eat the wrong foods, you'll eat too many foods, you'll lose judgment, you'll get carried away in sort of the
And Eleanor Roosevelt is the doyen of that idea because self-denial is her message. And she forces FDR to, I mean, do you think, when I read when you were talking about FDR eating this terrible food that she forced him to eat, I kept thinking, well, maybe he was going somewhere else, you know, like, because he actually did go somewhere else for his love life. Maybe he also went somewhere else for his food life. Do you think that's possible?
I mean, first of all, what the meal was, the 6.5 cent luncheon, and it was deviled eggs with tomato sauce, mashed potatoes, and prune pudding for dessert. And he essentially said through gritted teeth to the reporters afterward that it was good. But I think he really did go other places for his food. You know, he had polio and he built a built up a big retreat for polio victims in Warm Springs, Georgia.
That's right.
He spent a lot of time there.
Campobello also.
Yes. And every Thanksgiving he spent in Warm Springs.
Eating well.
Yes. And they had, instead of like a Henrietta Nesbitt prepared turkey, they had a traditional Southern big turkey dinner, and I think that was really where he really like let loose on his, you know, culinary interests, which were of, you know, the interests of a, you know, rich upper class guy who likes steak and plank salmon and caviar and, you know, a martini and everything like that. That's how he wanted to live. He didn't want to eat home ec food.
Right. I mixed up the people too. That's right. Nesbitt is the woman who Eleanor brought to cook terrible food.
Right. She was the White House housekeeper. Right.
But the woman who kind of was this early leader of the counter food movement was
Sheila Hibben,
who I was really interested in because she talked about healthy green food, you know, greens and food grown on a farm. It was kind of a different, or, you know, she was interested in a different theme.
Well, she wanted to bring pleasure back into the equation,
right,
and culture and tradition and
regional food,
regionalism, right, and history and all of the good stuff that food is. And that food could also be inexpensive and nourishing. So she didn't see a problem, right, with the two sort of going
well, because
together.
A lot of the people, food ways of many people are healthy, and they're just not the same as mainstream kind of modern, in quotes, American cooking of the 20s and 30s. So you probably have, at the same time as these scientific models of eating and all that kind of made up food that they were, or, you know, the advent of putting wheat germ in everything. What, isn't it true that wherever there were food ways of regular folks,
mm-hmm,
that their food was still being eaten, even though they might have had to modify their diets for, you know, as their economic situation wasn't as good. And I wondered if that, you know, like if you were a poor person on a farm in West Virginia, well, you might have been a poor person on a farm in West Virginia in 1920. You wouldn't be as bad off as someone in New York who went from a middle class lifestyle to a poor lifestyle.
Yeah, well, there's a whole sort of body of culinary folk wisdom, particularly among people who had to scrape together,
right,
their meals. They had strategies.
Right.
And I think part of the difficulty of the Depression was that so many people who didn't have strategies were suddenly thrust into poverty.
Right.
So what do you do if you're used to giving your family T-bone steak every night for dinner or standing rib roast? What do you do when you can't afford meat? Right. So,
and that's
there was
what
all
a lot
kinds
of
scrambling
the,
going
that's
on.
What a
yeah.
lot of this kind of new national, you know, it's kind of like a, it could be called home economics, but it was just this theme of helping people learn how to, relearn how to cook in a way. But it seems like a lot of the things they were cooking were just awful. Even by the standards of someone who doesn't have a lot of money, it's really hard to accept some of those foods.
Well, there's a funny thing about the food. Yes, a lot of it doesn't taste good, and we've made it. And it's not just the economical dishes. There were also home economics at the same period involved in the women's magazines who were cooking solidly sort of middle class foods, but using all kind of convenience foods, canned soups and gelatin mixes and other sort of foods of modernity. And we've made those recipes in our kitchen, like there was a salad made with canned corned beef, some kind of a flavored gelatin,
like a vinegar flavored gelatin, chopped celery, chopped cabbage, and hard boiled eggs. And I don't know if you've ever opened a can of canned corned beef, but or if you have a cat and opened a can of cat food,
yeah,
the smell is very, very similar. But then you add like the sort of crunchy vegetable and the sour taste of the vinegar.
it gets gelatin. Worse and worse.
And it just, it's awful from the visual to the smell to the taste. It just doesn't, right, it doesn't work on any level.
But the point is, I think that this was a food of ideas. This was food of the future.
Mm.
This was sort of modern technology meets the middle class kitchen. So there was a tremendous romance with these sort of foods of the future, all of these canned and prepared foods.
Right.
I mean, it didn't taste good, but it was exciting.
But
Right, because they were creating something new.
Right.
But at the same time, there was a theme of going back to the basics of cooking, kind of the American style, you know, like using whatever you have, a lot of potatoes and, you know, a certain potatoes and flour. It sounded like the foodstuffs were really all white things, you know, potato, flour.
White sauce was the big thing. Well, I mean, it was like a lot of root vegetables and cheap, like potatoes, canned tomatoes, and a lot of dairy products shoved into everything because dairy was like the world's most perfect food.
Right, and milk was plentiful in America. And at a certain point, wheat became plentiful again, you know, even though it had, I think that...
There was never a problem with resources. There was always food.
So it was just that the food wasn't getting to people because they couldn't afford it. So, well, and you did talk about, you know, various programs where, and I noticed that food kind of in storage was made available to poor people through programs. You know, this was sort of like the... you know, we've heard of this over the years, you know, the
surplus foods,
yeah. You know, the mountain of butter and the mountain of cheese.
Yeah, it hit put away. And then, you know, what happens to it after, you know, at a certain point, it's not edible anymore. Farmers being, you know, paid essentially to make food, grow food or manufacture food that can't be eaten, which seems terrible.
Bizarre.
Well, what happened was, is that, I mean, you had farm overproduction. The farmers were producing way more than anybody could afford to, you know, that a lot of people could afford to buy their stuff. And so the government started buying this surplus produce and handing it out to poor people to sort of balance the agricultural market. But the problem was, is that once that the agriculture production had been brought down, and now there was an, you know, and now they, and now that prices had been raised far enough that that farmers were getting a little bit of profit, they stopped buying the surplus produce, and that means that poor people no longer got anything.
Right.
So that's one of the ways in which the FDR's New Deal policies gave people food and then
took it away.
Yes, not a perfect system, and also that there was. This, you know, I was thinking about when you were talking about the farmers. There was a scene at the very beginning. I think it was during the beginning of the Depression when you couldn't get paid enough for the commodity, so the farmers were destroying either animals that they couldn't, you know, like if it was $1.12. Cost to raise the animal and a dollar that you would get from selling it, it wasn't worth selling it, so they would destroy it, which just seems awful, you know, to think about if there are poor people, hungry people somewhere, and food being destroyed.
Well, there was at the time people found out that farmers, the government was helping with this food destruction, and there was huge cry of outrage and.
Right.
Sort of that.
Right. It was
stop.
With pigs, actually. They were killing pigs in the Chicago stockyards.
Right.
And millions of people are starving, and they finally realized they had to do something.
So, and I think that you said this. I want to make sure this is right. But food stamps were invented during this period as well?
Food stamps were invented towards the end of the Depression, at the very end of the 1930s. Because after FDR took away a lot of the food social safety net programs, he realized it became clear that people were again starving. There was what was called the Roosevelt Recession in 37, 38, and 39. So the economy went down.
Right.
And people were hungry again. And people were scrounging on garbage dumps. I mean, it wasn't quite as bad as it was in the early 30s, but it was close. And they realized that they had to do something. And at the same time, actually, farmers started producing more than they could sell once again. So they began the food stamp plan to help people. They would use the food stamps to get the surplus produce.
Right. And it was a way of solving the problem of not wanting to just give people food at a really low price because that would undermine the grocery store world, you know, that so food stamps allowed people to go to the store, buy it using a food stamp.
Right.
And it kind of supported the capitalist methodology without undermining it.
Right. And because the Grocers Association had been protesting the previous surplus produce plan.
Right. So now having You know, one thing I thought about as I was kind of coming to the end of the book, it occurred to me that some of the things that happened during the Depression actually can grew into things that happened during the 50s and maybe a little later than that, where food became a subject of national magazines and television shows eventually. You know, it kind of leads in a way to Julia Child because, you know, you have all like people in the 50s were making food based on ideas they were getting from magazines, which is really what started earlier. And maybe was highlighted in the 1930s. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, we haven't brought didn't bring the story up to to the 1950s.
We stopped at 1940.
But I mean, one of the things that happened is, I mean, you have the World War II was a sort of big changing moment in a number of ways. And it sort of opened up Americans to the rest of the world because soldiers went all over and they tasted all these foods from all over. And so when they came back, they really wanted to eat those foods again. So that led to people like Julia Child and some explosion of Chinese food and a lot of other things. And so that was sort of one level of it. But on the level of like how people were eating, we were again in a kind of as far as for poor people, they were in a kind of 1920s, early 1930s situation, where there was again poverty and poor people weren't getting enough to eat, and there was no social safety net because Eisenhower and the Republicans were definitely not interested in any of that. And so the whole sort of food programs restarted again under LBJ, who revived food stamps and a lot of other things with his war on poverty. And that really sort of brought us into, you know, the present day.
Right. So what you're basically, you know, in some ways in this book, highlighting the continuity of this argument over food and, you know, value systems and who gets to eat and who gets to eat well. You know, we have today, you have the same, I mean, you have a lot of the same issues and disparities of culture and wealth and poverty. Not so different.
Yes.
Makes you wonder.
Yes.
So are you interested in continuing this kind of historical work? I mean, do you want to write about the foodways of the 1940s and the, you know, World War II, which is a kind of interesting period?
Well, no one's done it. And it is very interesting, but I think our next books are going to be on different topics.
So, and you will write separately? It sounds
separately.
We're going to go into, our own projects, but that's not to say we won't come back together.
But was it hard? Did you find it difficult to collaborate? Because
well, we're still married.
Well, that's a sign.
So we survive.
Yeah, I mean, you just sort of work it out as you go. I mean, we certainly didn't have a plan. But it sort of fell into, like, you know, we worked on alternating chapters. Jane did some chapters, and I did, you know, and then I would do the next and things like that.
But you managed to maintain. I found that the voice of the book is very consistent. So,
well, we worked on that.
Yeah, you worked and did really well. And it's a very conversational style. You know, you move right along. And I don't think as a reader, you don't kind of get. Like the style is fairly transparent, which is a good, for me, I think that's a good sign. You know, it's like a well-designed house. You don't notice that it was designed. So you did a good job in that way. But I think that must be challenging to subsume a voice and, you know, create a new one. That's the two of you.
Well, what's funny is that I see different voices. I see me and I see Andy, but... You know, we know each other well enough and we kind of share enough in terms of our point of view that we can sort of speak harmoniously produce this sort of narrative, this uninterrupted.
But what happened was, but also we did, I mean, once we got, you know, finished the first draft, I mean, you see that there's like certain transitions and things like that weren't working well.
Right.
So we sort of like, you know, stuck some things in here and there, sort of, you know, stuffed some stuffs in the cracks.
Right.
So the light wouldn't shine through, and it worked. And suddenly, you know, after that phase of editing, just, you know, we were worried about it, you know, was this going to work or not? And then we sort of looked at it and said, hey, this isn't so bad.
No, I thought really, it was really good. And it's like, it's hard to tell a story about a big period of time with a lot of things going on. You know, you have multiple narratives, essentially.
Well, the strategy was always not to tell the whole story,
right,
but just to pick these representative moments.
Right.
And
places and
moments, right, and places,
right. But it was a research
and that
monster.
That would stand still, for the bigger.
Yeah. It was still. It took us. The research took us just to get all the information and digest it.
Did you have to travel and go look at original materials and
National Archives in D.C., National Archives in Kansas City, Missouri, FDR Library, et cetera, et cetera.
Cornell has a huge home economics collection.
Right. Hoover was from Iowa, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. The Hoover Presidential Library is in West Branch, Iowa.
I've been there.
But we did not. We did get some stuff remotely, but we didn't go there because it turned out that there wasn't much, because he said no to giving relief, there wasn't much material because there was nothing going on.
Right, right. So have you found any themes in this that lead you to want to do, you know, to further exploration? You know, that stuff that you looked at in the Depression that you would want to explore in other projects?
Well, I can say that my current project, instead of taking the story forward, is taking the story backward. So I'm going back to that turn of the century period when home economists were just getting their act together, and looking at that sort of initial flowering. I love home economists. I think they're really fascinating women. They're kind of heroes on one hand, and then they got caught up in sort of biases of their moment,
right,
that they couldn't think their way beyond, like all of us. You know, we're all caught up in some kind of biases. So they were, you know, flawed heroes.
And how about you, Andy?
Well, I think that I don't know what my next food book will be. But I think it's fascinating that if I don't do it, somebody else should do it. Is a book about is that book about the 40s, 50s, and 60s in American food? And I mean, one of the things is, you know, doing this book is that we realize that the sort of viewpoint that people get about what happened during the Great Depression and the New Deal and everything like that, which a lot of it comes from people's, you know, current politics, is very distorted, and that we don't really have a sort of clear picture of what actually went on. And a lot of characters are flawed characters. FDR, Hoover, all these people, they did good and bad. And, you know, none of them are perfect. And I think that it would be really interesting to look at the decades that followed. And wrapping up with LBJ and just what happened then, because that really does. I mean, it's the world that we live in now. We're still debating these issues, and we don't seem to be able to get beyond them. And I think it would be great if hope is that if people had a clearer idea of what actually happened, maybe we could move on to a sort of more productive debate.
Yeah, I think that would be hopeful. When what one fears is that it would, you know, people are just simply unable to get outside of their own biases. You know, you could just thought of a new word you could create called bias sphere.
That's right. Exactly. That's a good one. Yes, I like that. Right here. We heard it here first.
But it does seem, you know, you would hope that reading history and understanding what happened, where things are really either the precursors or continuations of things that we know today would help people understand their thinking better. But I think the problem is that so many people, all of us, have trouble getting outside of our predispositions. It's like your home home economists who really had, they were doing, you know, I agree with you. I think they had really great ideas, but they, and great inclinations, but they were bound by their own experiences. And then you also have this notionality, and I think it's hard to escape, of telling other people how to live.
Mm-hmm.
Comes with it a certain, a set of problems.
Exactly.
That are really difficult.
That's exactly it, because if you're telling someone how to live, how to do it,
right,
you must think that you know better.
Exactly.
So you're coming from a position of superiority.
Right.
And talking down. And once that starts happening, right, all kinds of things.
Right. And in many ways, that is the problem we all have, because instead of listening, we tell.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a hard, I think that highlights one of the difficulties. So if we can, maybe if people get that from reading your book, that would be a good thing.
Our book.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for doing this interview. I really enjoyed talking to you about this book. It's called A Square Meal. It's by Andrew Coe and Jane Ziegelman. I'm David Wilk, your host. This has been Writer's Cast, and thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.